Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 75 years ago, June 6, 1944, D-Day during World War II, when American and Allied forces made the largest amphibious landing in history on the beaches of Normandy in western France to drive German Nazis back and retake Europe. This weekend, the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle will hold their annual Army Heritage Days with a focus on D-Day. Joining us today is Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, who is director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Colonel, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's great to be here today.
Also joining us is Professor Jarrett Frederick, a history instructor at Penn State Altoona and a World War II living historian. Professor Frederick, welcome to the show as well.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, let's talk about what plans there are, the events going on this weekend, because I wanted to talk about that right up front. This is a way for central Pennsylvanians, really everyone in the area who can travel to Carlisle this weekend, to focus on D-Day, learn about D-Day. What do you have planned?
Well, this is really a super weekend, both Saturday and Sunday from 9 to 5, where we really try to work hard to bring history alive, so to get more than just what you might experience in a textbook. We'll have just shy of 400 reenactors in period outfit with the gear and weapons appropriate for those time periods, covering all of the Army's history and our nation's history. Specifically for D-Day, we're going to have a couple of groups. We'll have a group of reenactors that are specifically targeting World War II soldiers, airborne paratroopers, that'll be there with all of their gear. And matched up with that, we're going to have twice a day, we're going to have flyovers of World War II aircraft. There will be both a C-47 Skytrain cargo transport aircraft, which would have transported paratroopers behind enemy lines during the Normandy invasion, as well as pulled gliders across that were, which is a large part of how the 101st actually came into the battlefield. And matched up with that will be a P-51 Mustang fighter escort aircraft that also did close air support for ground troops during the war.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that there will be reenactors of not just World War II, but all of America's history, correct?
Right. We cover from actually before we had an American army up through current operations. And so there will be groups of reenactors scattered across our 47-acre campus, replicating all kinds of things from not just combat units, but also the support aspects of things. We'll have hospital units out there. We'll also represent other militaries as well.
And when you're talking about reenactors, I mean, these are not just men and women who are playing a role. Almost all reenactors are living historians, as Professor Frederick is. But you know, these are people that, if your children or any age has a question about American history, about American military history, American army history, that they can learn from these reenactors.
Right, absolutely, Scott. These reenactors are professionals and educators in their own right. Most of them are experts on their specific time period or their unit. It's phenomenal to see people go around and truly something, as you said, for there's something there for all ages. Whether you're a child that's just curious about one aspect of how some piece of equipment works, or whether you're an adult with detailed questions about a specific battle, these reenactors are well-versed in addressing that.
I have to tell our audience, they may know that, you know, I wasn't here last week, and I was in Normandy leading part of a WITF travel club for the 75th anniversary of D-Day to London, Paris, and Normandy. So I got to see a lot of this firsthand. But one of our tour guides said something that really struck me, and I wanted to get the two of you to talk about this as well, is that, you know, here in the United States, when we commemorate events, we usually do it on even numbers, or those numbers like, you know, 25th, 5th, 10th, 50th. 75th is not exactly the most popular. You would think that, because I think someone asked a question, why not wait to the 100th to have this big celebration? Well, there's a reason for that. And that is that by the 100th, many of the men and women who lived through D-Day and World War II will not be around. And this probably will be the last commemoration where the people who actually lived through it can tell their stories. Yes, I've recorded many interviews with the veterans who lived through World War II, but the people who actually lived through it and, you know, fought in these battles were here at home during this time, that they're still alive. And that's why this 75th, it's one of the reasons it's so important.
It really is. If you think about it, a 20-year-old soldier is going to be 95 this year from that time period. And many of us still have family members or connections to family members that are that way. It's important that we have these commemorations now, where we can still capitalize on those individuals and draw out their memories and experiences while there's still time left. Because, as you pointed out, that clock is running out pretty quickly.
We're losing, I think the last I saw was like 1,000 World War II vets a day. My guess is it's probably higher than that now. Professor Frederick, you are a history instructor at Penn State Altoona, but a World War II living historian. What does the 75th mean to you, and kind of that broad question, mean to the people who should think back and remember what happened 75 years ago in June 1944?
I think a good way to answer that question is to reflect upon some numbers initially. During World War II, there were about 16 million Americans who served in uniform, and so that was roughly one out of every eight people living in the United States at that time. By contrast, it's about one out of every 100 people living in the United States wear the uniform today. And as of the moment, roughly speaking, there's probably less than about 100,000 World War II veterans left in the United States. And so organizations like my own that portray the 4th Infantry Division in World War II, we really see this as a moment where the torch is being passed, where we are absorbing some of these stories of the World War II generation firsthand, so we can then pass them on to younger generations that perhaps will not have the opportunity to learn those stories firsthand. And as the Colonel mentioned a moment ago, living history or reenacting is really a wonderful moment for people to reflect upon that. It really offers a tangible sense of history where you can pick up a helmet, you can pick up gear, and it offers a whole other dimension of perspective on, you know, the daily struggles and sometimes tragedies that these young men and women went through 75 years ago.
So let's talk about D-Day itself, Operation Overlord, because we can't have this conversation with the assumption that everyone knows exactly what happened and what we're talking about. So, Professor Frederick, what would be your quick synopsis, I hate to do that, but of what happened on June 6, 1944?
Sure. And, to think about that, we need to put it into some global perspective first, because certainly the war in Europe in World War II had been ongoing for many years up until that point. And the Soviet Union had been bearing the brunt of the damage on the Eastern Front well into 1944. For our listeners, visualize it as a vice of sorts. The Russians are fighting on the Eastern Front, and here in June 1944, the Allied coalition consisting of primarily U.S., Canadian, British, and Free French troops are going to be approaching from the other direction, and the Germans are caught in the middle of that vice. And between June of 1944 and May of 1945, the Allied forces from both the East and the West will be bringing an end to Nazi Germany.
I mentioned just a few minutes ago that I was at Normandy last week. A couple things that surprised me, and you can talk about this as to the strategic reasons for this, but Pegasus Bridge. Three gliders landed at Pegasus Bridge in France. behind what was supposed to be behind the German lines along the coast of Normandy. I mean, I've heard the story many times, but was really surprised when I saw how small of a space this was, where there was this bridge and three gliders land, say, within 150 yards of where German troops are, and they did it in silence. Now, it's nighttime, so there may be German troops sleeping, but heavily fortified. I mean, just the precision that kind of thing took, but that's the kind of planning that went into this, right, Professor?
Absolutely. And Pegasus Bridge, the story of it, is really one of the iconic stories of the invasion. There were glider troops of the 6th British Airborne Division that landed, like you said, within mere yards of this bridge under the noses of a completely unsuspecting enemy. And for all intents and purposes, they were some of the first Allied troops into Normandy and really laid down the foundation for the other assaults that would follow later that day. But in many ways, that story is symbolic of many stories of months long of planning and logistics. And there's one phrase that comes to mind. There was an American reporter who was in England during the mobilization phase for D-Day, and he described it as a perpetual mechanical Niagara, that it was just this perpetual stream of men and equipment and supplies and ships and vehicles and ammunition and medical supplies that was, it seemed never-ending. And so it was a true logistical and strategic feat of the highest order.
Mm-hmm. Colonel?
Professor Frederick just touched on something a minute ago that I think is worth reminding listeners, which is at this point in the war, this was a very seasoned army and allied force that was conducting this operation. I mean, from the initial invasions into Africa and the push across the eastward across the African continent, and then working their way from Sicily up the Italian boot, there had been numerous amphibious operations at this point. We were pretty well versed at doing airborne and glider operations. And so by the time we get to this point in the war, the Normandy invasion, this really was America and the Alliance bringing their A game to the fight.
Well, when you look at the logistics that went into this, I mean, you mentioned logistics and military logistics. You know, a lot of people want to talk about the battles, about the strategies. But when you talk about D-Day and Operation Overlord, the logistics are just as fascinating because of so much planning.
Absolutely.
That went into it.
Absolutely. I mean, because it's that waterfall. It's the surge of power behind the initial fighting soldier that really makes us successful on the battlefield.
I think I read that you have a glider at Army Heritage Days this weekend.
What we'll have is we'll have the P-47 that would have pulled the glider.
Okay, so you don't have an actual glider.
We don't have an actual glider on display this weekend.
Okay. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I wanted to pass this along. On June 6th, Smart Talk travels to the Eisenhower National Historical Site in Gettysburg to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Join us for the Smart Talk road trip and watch the broadcast of the show live. We'll talk about the famous Normandy landings, part of Operation Overlord, which was orchestrated by the future President Eisenhower. Then stick around to explore the historic site of President Dwight D. Eisenhower's home and farm. Register for this free event at WITF.org, supported by Roof Advisory Group. Go to WITF.org/events and you can RSVP. But on D-Day itself, we get an opportunity to tour the Eisenhower farm. And there is a lot of military history there. It's funny how Dwight Eisenhower was the President of the United States, but very often he's still referred to as General Eisenhower rather than President Eisenhower. We're talking about U.S. Army Heritage War Days, Army Heritage Days, I should say, coming up this weekend at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle, focusing on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Our guest today, Jared Frederick, a history instructor at Penn State Altoona and a World War II living historian, and Jeffrey Mangelsdorf, who is director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. If you have a question or comment specifically about D-Day itself, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we get on to talking a little bit more about what happened 75 years ago, Professor Frederick, I have to ask about the future. It's kind of ironic we're talking about the future when we're discussing history. But, you know, earlier I asked about the, you know, those World War II vets you mentioned, about 100,000 that are still alive here in the United States. So that's one aspect of it. But you're in a classroom every day with young people who are learning about history. What does the future look like when we're talking about history and this history in particular?
Well, when I teach about D-Day in the classroom, I often try to do it through personal perspective. And it's sometimes difficult for college students to realize that this massive endeavor that Dwight Eisenhower called the Great Crusade was largely conducted by people their age. I mean, it was 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds who were flying these planes, operating landing craft, and hitting the shores of the Normandy coast. But at the same time, it's also a lot easier for their stories to resonate with young people because in many ways they share some of the universal themes of, you know, their lives, you know, at that point. And so, you know, teaching it through personal perspective, you know, it's not all just about strategy. It's not all just about logistics. You really have to take history down to a boots-on-the-ground perspective. And I and, you know, a lot of reenactors try to incorporate that same philosophy when we educate the public at something like Army Heritage Days.
And, you know, we've had several, and it wasn't planned this way, but several programs this week since I returned that, you know, do focus on history. And just yesterday, we were talking about preserving historic documents. And our guest at that time said something that I just wanted to get your thoughts about, the two of you, is that I don't know whether we've had an actual change or just we're noticing it more, but just what Professor Frederick said, that people who are interested in history today or becoming more interested in history want to hear about the people and what they experienced rather than the focus on the great battles, the military strategy, the, you know, the numbers, the statistics, that they are more interested, that they can relate more.
No, absolutely. You've Scott, you've tapped on something that really resonates through what we're finding increasingly resonates through young adults right now. There's this strong desire for authenticity. They want to see and touch. There's a tactile level of learning going on. But people, what we're finding is people read about things online, and that's interesting. It actually piques their interest. But then, if anything, that encourages them to go out and seek out the actual document to be able to touch something that was written 50, 75 years ago, to be able to touch that helmet that Professor Frederick was talking about earlier. It's a different level of learning than we normally traditionally think about in classroom environments.
Last week in London, I was in the Churchill, where the bunker were, it's hard to call it a bunker, but saw the document signed by Prime Minister Chamberlain and Adolf Hitler before the war, that where Germany promised not to invade Europe just before they did. But anyway, a signature by Adolf Hitler, not something you see very often. Now, you know, we may not have something on that level, but I know exactly what you're talking about, that you more questions arise in your mind and you can appreciate it when you see it firsthand.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, at the Army Heritage and Education Center, we are the Army's archival holdings for historical documents. And we literally have over 5 miles of shelf space with just unclassified material. And the thing specifically, you know, circa World War II period, you know, run the full gamut from the original classified operations orders for the Normandy invasion through map sheets with hand-drawn markings on them made by soldiers and leaders as the battle was unfolding, to photographs, diaries, even audio recordings from that time period.
Mm. Professor Frederick, I'm going to go back to the classes that you teach. What question arises most often when it comes to World War II or D-Day?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. You know, a lot of the base of knowledge that students have about D-Day, for better or for worse, comes from movies and video games. A lot of them have seen the movie Saving Private Ryan. They may have played, you know, a World War II video game. I certainly don't see that as a bad thing necessarily. It serves as some sort of foundation that I can build upon. But much like Jeffrey said, you know, students seek, you know, a kind of level of authenticity. And I bring in a full D-Day kit into the classroom, and, you know, a student volunteers, and, you know, we dress them up in a kit. And, you know, and that sort of offers that, like I said, tangible sense of history. And in cases more often than not, that opens up the door to, you know, a broader dialogue about what does it mean to be a World War II soldier, why are they fighting, what are they wearing, how is it affecting their lives, what are the daily struggles that they are going through. And those are some of the themes that students are really interested in.
When you say a D-Day kit, a paratrooper, infantry, what?
An infantry soldier. In many ways, Operation Overlord, which was the code name for the Normandy invasion, it could have well been named Operation Overload, because that's how a lot of these guys were packed up. And you have, you know, these guys went to the Great Depression. You know, they were very fit. They were very trim. And, you know, some of them had 80 or 90 pounds of gear as they were heaved off the landing craft and plunged into 7 feet of water. So as a student is trying on all this equipment, I'm trying to visualize to them, you know, you're in 7 feet of water, there's people shooting at you, and it really adds a whole other layer of perspective.
And then even if once you get out of the water, there's a significant amount of beach there that you've got to cross.
Mm-hmm. While being shot at.
Scott, you could talk to that firsthand for our listeners, but right, while being shot at, you've got 90 to 100 pounds of gear with you, you've got to make it across a pretty large beachhead, and so that starts to bring to life some of the accounts that you read about why people were dropping their gear, even once they're out of danger on the march, why people would cast things off that later they wish they had held on to.
Well, one of the things that does strike you when you're actually visiting the beaches and you hear these stories of how many American soldiers actually drowned,
right,
because of once they got out into that 7 to 10 feet of water and had all that gear that was weighing them down and couldn't get out of the water, or the tanks that were supposed to be able to make it through the water that didn't. Quite frankly, there was a lot that could have gone wrong. And it was just by all that planning, some of it worked, some of it didn't, but just that overwhelming force, because there was a lot that did go wrong, right, Professor?
Oh, yeah. At the outset, it seemed like there were more things going wrong than right. There were mechanical failures. There were breakdowns in communication. Soldiers were landing on the wrong beaches. The tides were rising on the beach, and so that shrinks the amount of land that men had to walk upon, and it just seemed like one thing after another. But, you know, that conveyor belt, you know, that might be a good way to visualize it, of troops just keep funneling ashore. And ultimately, through sheer force of numbers and determination, you know, the Allies were able to overcome these very formidable beach obstacles and defenses as a result that day.
Omaha Beach, we've seen the video many times of American soldiers unloading and running across the beaches, and we've, you know, seen that video where some of them are being shot at the time. Observation. Now, I'm really kind of, what strikes you is, first of all, how small that beach is. Secondly, that the Germans are up on top of pretty big hills shooting down. I mean, it looked like a shooting gallery, quite frankly. Now, Utah Beach, where other Americans landed, a little bit wider, not as hilly. But just if I was an American soldier and, you know, and looking back on it now, and I had my choice between Utah and Omaha Beach, I'd take Utah any second, I'll tell you that.
Indeed, and actually, my grandfather was at Utah Beach. He was in the 4th Infantry Division. That's one reason why I portray the unit that I do. And I'm sure he would have agreed with you that Utah Beach was a much better place to land than Omaha.
Not that it was a picnic or anything, but Omaha was something else. On our trip, we had one of the guests that we had on the trip, his father actually landed at Omaha Beach. And it's, again, just hard to picture. She said that her father really never talked about it. That's kind of what this whole generation, very often you hear stories like that. And just as the 75 years, as they get older, it seems as though we do hear the stories more often, Jeff.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic where as people age, they start to get much more open about sharing these experiences. Maybe there's a sensing there that it will be lost. But, you know, it really is a phenomenal testament to the adaptability of what was then America's youth, you know, these young adults being thrown into unimaginable situations, the adversity, and yet they adapted, right? And very quickly formed, whether it was little groups of paratroopers behind enemy lines or formed ad hoc units on the fly, on the beach, under fire to breach an obstacle and then move on. Because really there was no other option. And so maybe these are some of the most important lessons that we ought to be trying to convey to today's young adults, is that, yes, you too can get through these problems. It's not as unimaginable as you might think it is.
Mm. Well, we're almost out of time for this portion of the show. I want to thank the two of you for being with us today. Jeffrey Mangelsdorf is director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Jarrett Frederick, a professor, a history instructor at Penn State Altoona, and a World War II living historian. Final word, Colonel, on Army Heritage Days this weekend?
Come out and see us Saturday and Sunday, 9 to 5. We'll have something for everyone. It's free food, free parking.
Yeah, I
free admission.
The food was, you know.
If you find me, I'll buy you a cheeseburger. But we'll have food out there as well. Come by and see us this weekend.
Thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Just want to remind you of some of the topics that we'll be discussing here in the near future. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking about bees and where we are. You know, we've been losing a lot of pollinators here in the last few years. Talk about bees. Also, Pennsylvania State Animal Response Team coming up next week. We'll be dealing with some issues that are at the forefront here in Harrisburg and across the country. Abortion is a big issue right now across the country. It is one of the programs that we'll be focusing on next week, including legislation here in Pennsylvania. Also, want to be talking about some other things that are happening at the state capitol. That is coming up next week. So be sure to tune in or go to WITF.org/smarttalk. You can see the topics that we have planned for the program. Actually, you can leave a voicemail or a voice message if you can't get on the telephone during the hour. hour in which we're on the air. A special election is scheduled for May 21st to elect a new representative in the 12th Congressional District vacated by Congressman Tom Marino earlier this year. Joining us today is Fred Keller, the Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 12th District. The 12th District includes Perry, Juniata, Mifflin, Snyder, and Union counties, and parts of Northumberland and Montour counties in the WITF listening area. Representative Keller, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott, and good morning to everybody listening.
Well, thanks a lot. Start off by asking the broad question, why are you running?
I'm running for Congress, and it's the same reason I ran for the state House seat. You know, when you look at how our government was designed and the founders of our great nation, the republic that they laid out, and the republic that laid out with our rights and our values that have been paid for by every generation of veterans since and our active duty military personnel now, gave me an opportunity that every American should have. You know, I lived the American dream. I was a poor kid. You know, when we grew up, we were poor, and I know everybody says, oh, we were poor, and we didn't know it. It was abundantly clear to us that we were poor. But we knew if we didn't let people define us, and if we didn't let our government define us, and we worked hard and we went to school, we could succeed. You know, and I, after graduating from high school, I got a job in a factory, and you know, later managed that factory. I had started working in as a graduate right out of high school, had my own small business, and in 2010, the citizens, my friends and neighbors in Union and Snyder counties, elected me to the General Assembly in Harrisburg, and you know, I went there to take the values of our district and you know what made our country so great. I took that to Harrisburg, and because I did what I said I was going to do, I got reelected overwhelmingly four times. And just keeping that service in mind and making sure that, you know here's this person who grew up the way many people do, with an attachment to, you know, what it's like to work in a factory, what it's like to run a business, and give back to the community. And I think that that's what we look at in service. And I have the opportunity to give back and be that voice of the people that have either worked their whole life and are retired, or the ones that are getting up and going to work every day. And it's been quite an honor in the Pennsylvania General Assembly, and I hope that you know, my experience and what I've done over my lifetime resonates with the voters, and they send me to take our values to Washington, D.C.
Earlier this week, we had a conversation with your Democratic opponent. Why are you a better candidate for the people of the 12th Congressional District, in your opinion?
Well, you know, again, I'll tell people why I'm qualified. The fact is that I understand what it's like. You know, a lot of people, you know, talk about people being disadvantaged or poor. I understand what it's like to have to be poor and live and manage and get things done. I understand what it's like to have to work in a factory. I understand what it's like to run a larger business. I understand what it's like to have start my own small business. And you know, I understand what it's like to do community service work and help with the Scouts and many other organizations in the community. I've done it over my entire lifetime. And I think that attachment to those values, having been deeply rooted right in the community and those experiences, and in addition to that, understanding how to take that to Harrisburg and get things done in Harrisburg and work with a group of people to accomplish a goal. I mean, you look at what's happened in Harrisburg. I mean, In 2010, we didn't have any money in a rainy day fund and a bunch of other things, and this year we're $825 million ahead of estimation on our revenue collections because of what we did to make sure we didn't overtax people, that we didn't overregulate people, and we let economy grow, and we let people do what they do best, and that's create jobs and go to work.
Let's talk about some issues and some of the hot button issues right now. And I say hot button, I just don't want to talk about hot button issues, but have to talk about some that are at the forefront of the news right now. You have placed a great deal of attention on agriculture. I understand that your stepfather was a family farmer. But right now, the tariffs and the ongoing trade escalation with China, we are hearing that Pennsylvania farmers and farmers overall are feeling some pain when it comes to those tariffs. Do you support the tariffs against China or this relationship that, it's been called a trade war? I don't know what a trade war is, but it is. If there's a trade war, this could probably be it between the United States and China with all the tariffs. Do you support what President Trump is doing?
Well, the first thing I want to say is, whenever anybody's having issues or difficulties, we want to make sure we're doing what puts the interests of the American worker, the American family, the American farmer first. And for too long, China, and I know they've been taking advantage of America, and I think Chuck Schumer said something about the president, we need to have China stop doing this. And if we want to do this, we finally got a president that's willing to say, hey, we're in it for what makes and puts America's farmers, families, and workers first. And, I want to make sure that we do whatever happens, that when we come through this, we're stronger, we're better, and America's interests are first. And I think that's what the president's looking at. I know they've tried a lot of things over time, but if you look at some of the things that have been renegotiated, the manufacturing jobs that have come back, it's not easy, it's difficult, but I want to work to make sure that whatever policies are in place benefit America's farms, America's families, and America's workers first.
Well, I think that you can get, you mentioned Senator Schumer, Democratic leader, that you could get people from both sides of the aisle who would agree that trade with China may not be even right now, that we import, to the United States imports a whole lot more than we export. But this, the tactic that the Trump administration has taken specifically, do you support?
Well, again, let's take a look at what happens. And we're not talking about the trade imbalance. We're talking about the fact that China has been taking advantage of American intellectual property and unfair trade practices against Americans and American businesses. So wanting to tackle an issue head on and try and bring it to resolution, I think that there's been many things that have been done in the past prior to the Trump administration that haven't worked. And I think there's a lot of people, while some things are difficult, are willing to give our president a little bit of latitude in trying to get things done that in the long run will benefit, again, America's farms, America's families, and America's workers.
Even though there are many farmers, I'm sure farmers in the 12th Congressional District who are feeling some pain right now because of the tariffs. How do you weigh that? You know, I've heard farmers say who supported the president say that, I'm willing to put up with the pain short-term for long-term gain. Of course, then I've heard other farmers say, I voted for Donald Trump, I won't do it again. How do you weigh the two?
Well, I think you weigh the two by being available and talking about the issues with people. And I think that you hit the nail on the head. There's some pain that goes along with some of this, but it's not pain that's been created by Donald Trump or the Trump administration. It's been going on for many years. And, when we look at standing up for farmers, it's not just trade. It's also some regulation that we deal with, waters of the U.S. and so forth, that impact American farmers right here. So I think the approach needs to be an all of the above approach. Let's work on the trade issues. Let's see what we can do to make sure things are fair, not just with China, but with other nations, putting America's interests first. And then also take a look at the regulatory environment so we can all succeed together and be competitive in a world market.
Let's talk about some other issues, Representative. Health care. What's your stance on health care?
Well, the first thing I want to say, because it's very important, that whatever we do with health care, we first and foremost, most importantly, cover pre-existing conditions. Once you get beyond that, then you need to look at competition and transparency. And I know some of that's come about with some of the drug things and prescription things that the president has been advocating for recently. But you can look at some of that model for all of healthcare. The one thing we cannot do, and I will not support, is socialized single payer healthcare. And when you talk about that, and I've talked to a lot of people about this, and done a lot of research. If you're familiar with two names, Charlie Gard and Alfie Evans, over in the UK where they have socialized single-payer systems, they were a toddler and an infant that were on life support, and the doctors told the parents, your children aren't going to survive, you need to disconnect their life support. And in the case of Charlie Gard, he could have come to the United States and gotten care, but they said, no, you can't go get care, and the parents had to disconnect their child from life support because a government bureaucrat told them that's what they had to do. Now, I'm going to tell you an experience I had with that. When my wife and I's son was three, Freddie was three, he had a head injury, and he was life-flighted to Geisinger Medical Center, and he was on life support for 26 days. The doctors repeatedly told us he's not going to live. They said it's not a 50% mortality rate, it's not a 95%, 100% mortality rate. He is not going to survive. He was on a vent for 26 days with many other, a drug-induced coma, all kinds of things, total life support. We were told many times, disconnect him, he's not going to live. But because we had control over his health care, because it wasn't the government, it wasn't somebody that didn't have Freddie's best interest at case, our son is now 27 years old and works for the hospital system that saved his life. Healthcare belongs in the hands of the people to make their decisions. And this single-payer system is no more than just saying we're going to discuss, that we, the government, are know better about your healthcare and are going to decide whether you, what kind of care you get, or whether you get care at all or not.
Well,
again, transparency, competition, and most of all, cover pre-existing conditions.
Well, and that was, you know, there are some that would argue with you that, you know, a big part of what universal health care is about is in making sure that everyone does have access to health care, where in this country there are millions of people who don't. But, you know, in
let me just say one thing about that, if I can. Creating a plan where somebody has coverage does not equal care. Just changing who pays the bill is not reform.
So you oppose the Affordable Care Act?
I think that we need to cover pre-existing conditions. So, you know, let's make sure we don't generalize things, okay? I oppose a single-payer system where you don't have choice and competition. I support covering pre-existing conditions. So that's really a difference in the two campaigns.
But from what I understand, though, you do oppose the pre-existing conditions part aside. You are opposed to the Affordable Care.
No, I do not. I said first and foremost, we cover pre-existing conditions.
Right, I understand that. But I'm saying, but you do oppose the ACA because of the increased cost, right?
I don't support the ACA because it just changes who pays the bill. It does not make it more fair. I mean, you can call it the Affordable Care Act. It didn't make it any more affordable. President Obama said you can keep your doctor, you can keep your health plan, and it's going to save you $2,500. Now, we all know how that turned out. It's costing working families more and more money than they were paying before.
Would you vote?
Guess what? They didn't get to keep their doctor, and they didn't get to keep their health plan.
Would you vote to repeal the ACA?
I would vote to fix our health care system and make sure we cover pre-existing conditions, create competition, and transparency.
Mm-hmm. Also understand, when I try to get to as many issues as I can in the 10 minutes or so we have, that you support infrastructure, upgrading our infrastructure. And this is an issue that, again, I think everyone can agree that the United States must upgrade and modernize its infrastructure. But still, it hasn't happened, and the biggest reason is how to pay for that. So someone who has said that you support doing something with the infrastructure, how do we pay for it?
Okay. The first thing I would say is I'm the one candidate in the race that has experience of having done that in Harrisburg. You know, they said for many years we were trying to get stuff passed to fix Pennsylvania's infrastructure. And right here in central Pennsylvania, the Central Susquehanna Valley Thruway that had been going on for 40 years is now being built. Infrastructure investments, because of work that I did with my colleagues and Governor Corbett in Harrisburg. So we did find ways to do it, and you know, you look, we looked at you know, paying for that with the user fee on uncapping the gas tax. But here's what you do: we've got a lot of infrastructure is roads and bridges, but it's much more. It's also broadband internet access, which is necessary for the delivery of health care. It's necessary for education. It's necessary for commerce. And also, for energy, we need to look at our pipeline infrastructure. And I think that's part of the where place you could start, is if we could get more of our natural gas to market and get more of that commerce going and grow our economy, we'll have more revenue to invest in infrastructure projects. Not taxing people more, but having more economic activity. And I can give you an example. Last year in 2018, there was LNG that originated in Russia that came into New England, into Boston Harbor. We need to stop transferring our wealth to other nations so that they can build their infrastructure. We need to export our energy resources. We need to consume our own energy resources, sell it to our allies, so that our allies aren't buying natural gas and other energy from Russians and people who do not share America's interests. Take that revenue, and that's how you fund infrastructure, because of more economic activity and growing our economy.
You talked about working with your colleagues in the legislature and in the Corbett administration with an infrastructure plan that was passed several years ago. You mentioned the user fee, but it also included an increase in the gasoline tax. Is that what it's going to take? How do you raise the revenue? And this goes back to my original question, to pay for an infrastructure upgrade.
Well, my answer on that was that we also look at our natural gas and our energy infrastructure, so that we can create more economic activity. See, we as the United States, and in my answer I told you already,
right,
that we had brought LNG in from Russia and paid Russia for natural gas in America. And our allies are buying natural gas and energy from Russia and other nations who do not share our interests. And those nations are getting wealth transferred to them. What we do is we take our energy resources, use them ourselves so we're not transferring wealth to another nation that doesn't share our interests, sell it to our allies so our allies aren't supporting nations that don't support our interests, and we take that money from that economic activity and use it to invest in our infrastructure. You know, a lot of people have talked about the Russians. If we want to stop the Russians and make sure they don't have resources to do things that are detrimental to the United States, let's bankrupt them and stop having us and our allies purchase their energy so that they have resources.
Mm-hmm. We only have about 3 minutes left, Representative Keller, and there's so many issues to talk about. Climate change. What are your thoughts on climate change, and what should the U.S. and the Congress be doing about it?
Well, again, there is climate change. The Green New Deal is what we should not be doing, because, and that my opponent has advocated for that, that would cost, and I the estimates are anywhere up to $93 trillion. I guess some of the organizations that he supports says it's $50 trillion. Okay, $50 trillion, I'll use his number or their number, would be $300,000 for every Pennsylvania family. Going broke and not having any resources to deal with climate change does not help us. We need to do things like I've done in the General Assembly with Act 13, which was the natural gas impact fee, that gave us resources that protected watersheds. I brought money back to my state house district from that money to protect watersheds around the Susquehanna River. As private industry, we need to encourage the more use of our natural gas, because that burns cleaner than coal or other fossil fuels. I helped stop, work alongside residents to help stop a tire burner. There's many things I have done to help make sure that our climate is as clean as we can keep it and we keep moving forward. But bankrupting us and putting us at a disadvantage so that other nations can pollute and change the climate of our Earth doesn't solve the problem. What we need to do is we need to make sure we have resources that are deployed efficiently and effectively to help that. But again, embracing policies that are more about control than really about affecting the climate don't help us at all.
Quickly, because I want to give you an opportunity to leave a message with voters, but I noticed you didn't mention renewables.
Oh, well, actually, part of my record in Harrisburg is renewables. I supported solar energy. It's in all of the above. It is in all of the above. You need wind, you need natural gas, you need solar, you need nuclear, coal, clean coal is all good. And my record, actually, I got legislation passed in Harrisburg with some budget materials that actually helped solar energy in Pennsylvania. That's my record, and it's a record I'm pretty proud of.
Representative Fred Keller, we only have about 45 seconds left. Always leave an opportunity for candidates to leave a message with the voters. What would that be?
Well, I would like to say that, you know, the people of the 12th Congressional District are outstanding individuals and families. It's a great district. We live in a great nation, and I know how hardworking they are, how intelligent people are, and I would just like to say I would appreciate that people want to find more out about me. They go to fredkellerforcongress.com, but I would appreciate their vote because I understand their values. I understand their struggles. My life has been one that, you know, sort of helps me understand that. My record is one that I'm very proud of, whether it's in private industry or in government or working in with nonprofits, of trying to make our communities better. And I think I've succeeded on that, and I want to make sure that the American dream remains alive and well for generations to come. Please vote for me on May 21st.
Representative Fred Keller, and running for Congress in the 12th Congressional District, made up of Perry, Juniata, Mifflin, Snyder, and Union counties, parts of Northumberland and Montour counties in the WITF listening area. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.